When the Valley was one of the worst examples of the national housing crisis, President Barack Obama came to Mesa to talk about it.
We will help between 7 and 9 million families restructure or refinance their mortgages so they can avoid foreclosure.
Tomorrow, the president is coming back to the Valley to talk about a housing recovery. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about what that recovery looks like, who's doing better, and who is still struggling. Plus, Arizona Department of Economic Security Director Clarence Carter has turned in his resignation. Carter was in the middle of the firestorm over mishandled and forgotten cases at Child Protective Services. We'll talk about what the next head of DES needs to focus on. And there were a lot of complaints from the public about no burn days in the Valley between Christmas and New Year's Day. We'll find out more about our winter air. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll look ahead to President Barack Obama's Thursday visit to Phoenix. He came to Mesa more than 5 years ago when the housing market had bottomed out. Now he's back to discuss the housing recovery. I'll talk with economist Anthony Sanders and realtor John Wake about who's actually benefiting from the recovery. Plus, Doug Ducey became Arizona's 23rd governor earlier this week. I'll ask Chuck Coughlin, former advisor to Governor Jan Brewer, about how Ducey should approach the job and some of his strengths. And Robbie Sherwood will check in with his suggestions for the new governor. We start today's program following up on the news that Clarence Carter will resign on Friday from his post as director of Arizona's Department of Economic Security. DES provides services for families who need assistance with, among other things, child care, food, and employment. Child Protective Services used to fall under DES's umbrella until the scandal involving thousands of ignored potential child abuse cases became public. That happened under Carter's watch. Joining me to talk about what the next DES director needs to do and focus on is Bruce Liggett, director of the Maricopa County Human Services Department and former chair of the Protecting Arizona's Family Coalition. Bruce, good morning. Thanks for fitting us in.
Good morning, Steve.
Bruce, before we get into the future, which we will focus on, I do need to ask you one question about the past, and that's that Clarence Carter drew heavy criticism for the scandals related to Child Protective Services. Did he deserve that criticism? What kind of grade would you give him overall as the head of DES?
Well, I think any time you sit in the chair as the director of DES, you're going to have all the responsibility and all the blame for what goes on with the agency. I think Clarence was trying to accomplish big things within DES, but there were so many resource issues that he had to address, he wasn't able to achieve those.
What qualities do you want to see in the next DES director, and how important are those qualities? Were there qualities in some cases that Clarence Carter had but couldn't implement change?
Well, you know, I think this hire is a critical hire. DES, as you mentioned, touches the lives of millions of Arizonans with huge, complicated programs involving public assistance benefits, employment programs, anti-poverty programs, domestic violence, homeless. Their reach and span are amazing. So this is a real opportunity. DES has always been much maligned, and a lot of it had to do with Child Protective Services. So the next director, I think, has an opportunity to focus on what it is, which is a human service agency and an employment agency that has a positive impact on so many Arizonans. I think what I'll be looking for is somebody who can get that message out and get the confidence and gain the credibility with the state legislature.
Bruce, is this an agency, and in general, that needs new blood with every major job that comes along? We always have to hear the phrase national search. Would that help in this case?
I think it would. I think it's important to have a seasoned human services professional, somebody who's got the experience at that level with this complexity of programs, somebody who doesn't have to come in and try to understand the various missions of the different federal programs, the state programs, the complicated statutes. So I think it's time to find somebody who's that seasoned professional.
Are there certain things you'd like to see emphasized at DES that haven't received enough attention? Are there clear improvements, as someone who's been in this sort of realm for a long time, that regardless, and obviously we have to talk about budget at some point, but regardless of budget, really should happen?
Well, budget's going to be critical, and I think we can talk about that. But I think the next director needs to involve the community and stakeholders in discussions. I think there's a tremendous opportunity to bring people to the table to explain the challenges that DES faces, to wrestle with some of the problems, and to try to get consensus on some of the solutions. I think that would be a big change in terms of how people locally are involved.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Bruce Liggett, Director of the Maricopa County Human Services Department. We're talking about the next Director of the Department of Economic Security here in Arizona. Bruce, I guess looking forward, is there something that is strong about the current DES setup? I know with bureaucracies, things can get complicated, but is there something you'd like to definitely keep in place?
Well, I've been a student of DES for about 40 years, since the mid-70s, and the whole rationale was putting several programs together to try to make them work in an integrated fashion to better serve the families whose needs are complicated. So the basic structure is there and in place. But one of the things that's not been done enough is to kind of articulate what the needs are. There's so many expectations for DES, and they're so under-resourced, and there's resource challenges that the state faces. But I think being really clear and transparent about to what degree DES is able to meet the need is a critical step.
How worried are you that a position like this becomes political? Because it's going to be someone appointed by the governor. Does that worry you going forward?
In the past, governors have not made highly political appointments with these positions. They've tended to bring in experienced human service professionals. So that's what I'm hoping happens here. My concern, and I think many of the advocates and the providers concerned out in the community, is that they'll be looking for places to make cuts in programs that have already been cut so severely over the past many years.
Yeah, the state's budget, again, of course, in a deep hole. We heard Doug Ducey earlier this week saying that he will not be raising taxes and would not support raising taxes. So one would think there would have to be more cuts. And could an agency like DES, obviously it would survive cuts, but would the people who need DES survive those cuts?
Any more cuts to DES programs, it's going to have a severe impact on people. And I think there's a tendency with a new administration to want to emphasize trying to make cuts softened by efficiencies. But DES has been through efficiency projects going back to Project Slim with Governor Symington. And the cuts over the years in the infrastructure of DES have taken their toll. They've got a automated system that could collapse any time, I think. So I think that's what many will be watching to see if there's going to be some simplistic solutions, like we could just operate more efficiently. Operating more efficiently won't restore the $80 million cut to child care funding, for example.
Are you seeing more and more people who need these services, Bruce?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Arizona is not recovering. Our unemployment rate is still above the U.S. average. Our poverty trends are heading in the wrong direction, with one in four Arizonans, almost one in four, at the poverty level. It's higher for children, almost one in five. So we're trending in the wrong direction. We're countercyclical. As Arizona struggles to recover, more people need DES.
Bruce Liggett is director of the Maricopa County Human Services Department, also former chair of the Protecting Arizona's Family Coalition. Bruce, thank you for the time today.
Absolutely, Steve. Take care.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. More than 5 years ago, when the Valley was still in the deep throes of the housing crisis, President Barack Obama visited Mesa to talk about it.
The home mortgage crisis, the financial crisis, and this broader economic crisis are all interconnected. We can't successfully address any one of them without addressing them all. So yesterday, in Denver, I signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which will create or save 3.5 million jobs over the next 2 years, including 70,000 right here in Arizona. Right here. Doing the work America needs done. And we're also going to work to stabilize, repair, and reform our financial system to get credit flowing again to families and businesses. And we will pursue the housing plan I'm outlining today. And through this plan, we will help between 7 and 9 million families restructure or refinance their mortgages so they can avoid foreclosure.
That was 2009 in Mesa. President Obama will be speaking at Central High School tomorrow morning about the housing recovery. In a statement, the White House said the president will also announce new steps to help more Americans achieve the American dream of owning a home. With me now to talk about the housing recovery, where it's being felt, where it isn't, and where we go from here, our Professor Anthony Sanders of George Mason University, who specializes in real estate finance and investment, and Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com. Welcome back to both of you.
Well, thanks a lot, Steve.
Professor Sanders, so how much has the real estate market nationally recovered since 2009? What have we seen? What have we not seen?
Well, what we've seen is house prices come back about, they're still 20, depending on the area, 24% below their peak back in the 2000s. Now, foreclosures have actually dropped back to normal levels, although they seem to be creeping up recently. So the housing market's recovering, and it's kind of with a broken leg.
Wow. So what is President Obama going to say here in Phoenix tomorrow? And I don't want to make this political. Why did he decide to come back to the Phoenix area? Any thoughts on that?
Phoenix, as you know, is sort of the poster child for the housing bubble. Dramatic price increases of housing, followed by dramatic price decreases of housing. But what he's going to announce tomorrow, very likely, is the fact that he's going to try to increase the number of home loans, not so much in Phoenix per se, but nationally, is to lower the guarantee fee for the FHA loans by 0.5%.
What sort of impact do you think that could have?
Actually, I don't think it'll have much impact at all.
Okay. John Wake, your thoughts?
Yeah, totally. It's a small increase. It's a very, very modest if it had any effect on the market. The bigger impact that could happen on the market is if we have an interest rate increase in this year.
Right, which, Tony Sanders, what about that?
Well, I think right now, over the past year, interest rates keep decreasing.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. It's just not the Federal Reserve trying to keep rates low. It's just that the rest of the world, economies are just completely stalled. And globally, everyone's lowering the rates to try to jumpstart their economies. No one's succeeding, and so rates are perhaps likely to stay low for this coming year, unless something happens.
Tony Sanders, I want to come back to one thing about. Of course, we all know about Phoenix being the poster child or whatever for the housing bubble, and yet this is not a place that President Obama is especially popular. And it also doesn't feel like to a lot of people that there has been, certainly housing has improved, no question, but it still doesn't feel like for a place that relies so much on housing and real estate that it really has recovered. The timing seems odd to a layperson like me. What about that?
Well, I think, there's a political aspect to this. He's trying to tout how his administration has really helped the economic recovery, particularly for Phoenix, although I think that'd be a bad city to pick for. But I think we're coming up to a presidential election pretty soon. I think he wants to say his policies have worked really well. But the problem is he might even tout the loan modification programs, HAMP and HARP. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that's not had much of an impact, and particularly Phoenix. And again, the reason why is if you look nationally and particularly at Maricopa County, unemployment rates, as your previous guest I heard was saying, are still unacceptably high. Median household income it kind of grew during the last decade. It's been falling in Phoenix. So that's a very difficult market to really jumpstart the economy in.
John Wake, what are you seeing? I know it can be anecdotal, but based on what you've seen over the past couple of years, who are you able to sell to? Who's interested in talking to you about buying a home?
Well, a lot of the stuff that we don't see are the first-time home buyers, because they've been really, they're in their 20s or 30s, and they have huge student loans, and then the economy is not picking up. Actually, the economy, it is improving, and they're benefiting more than the rest of the economy, the people in that age group. So we could see them more and more come in and get their first homes. But first home buyers are always a huge percentage of the sales, maybe in the 40% range of sales. So hopefully they're getting their feet on the ground, and they're coming in.
I read that small phrase that the White House issued in that statement about the American dream. And of course, during the downturn, we heard, well, that's not really the American dream as much anymore for young people. What are you seeing?
Yeah, that's definitely the problem, is that they just don't have the bucks to do it. One of the things they're doing with this, maybe tweaking the FHA loan program, if that's what happens tomorrow, that could help, but it's going to be slight. It's it's not going to be the things we need to improve the market. But actually, the market, to get to the nuts of it, the market, the prices of home prices in Metro Phoenix have increased in about a year. I mean, there some areas have, like, dinner downtown Phoenix. Maybe the places that were really hit hardest, like Maryvale, are still coming up, but they were really killed by price decreases. So those areas are coming up a little bit. Basically, prices have been flat for a year, probably will remain flat. So that's good. Stability, price stability is good for buyers and sellers.
Tony Sanders, before we go to a quick break, you're a philosopher. What about this American dream? Housing still part of the American dream?
Well, I think it went from American dream to American scream when, you know, we had millions of people going into foreclosures, housing prices tanked. And again, everyone keeps forgetting the unemployment rate shot up. And, you know, and this is a kind of a bigger picture issue. Wage income has just declined and gotten stagnant. So we're not really seeing the growth in wages that everyone had hoped for. And this is, what, almost 6 years going into the Obama administration. We're not seeing any much improvement in the wage market.
Yeah, there's an interesting variable on that is when the economy is not booming, we're not getting people moving to Arizona. We're way below what our traditional number of people, and that always drives the housing mm-hmm. market and the whole Arizona economy. And since the economy isn't increasing that well, people are not moving here, and it has a spiral effect.
And we'll talk more about that coming up. John Wake is a realtor. You can read his stuff at ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com. Professor Anthony Sanders of George Mason University specializes in real estate finance and investment. You can find his blog at Confounded Interests. We'll discuss more about real estate in America and Arizona coming up next after this break.
KJZZ is supported by ASU College of Public Service and Community Solutions. New name, new speaker series, Why Death and Grief Are Needed for Life and Joy. Tuesday, January 20th, downtown Phoenix. Details at publicservice.asu.edu/talks.
Now on KJZZ. A sunny day across Arizona today. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now. It's 50 degrees up at the Grand Canyon, 70 in Tucson, 43 in Flagstaff, 55 in Prescott. Casa Grande reporting 57 degrees. It's cloudy and 68 right now in Yuma. Checking valley traffic on the I-10 westbound. Watch out for a crash on the shoulder at Riggs Road. Well, your cell phone can keep you linked to friends and family on social media and lets you stay on top of your busy schedule. And now you can connect to your news and information all day long with the new KJZZ app for your phone. You can stream KJZZ, get the latest news and podcasts, give us feedback, and more. Download your KJZZ app at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Partly sunny skies right now in Phoenix, and it's 67 degrees at 11:24.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're talking about President Barack Obama's visit to the Valley on Thursday with Professor Anthony Sanders of George Mason University and Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com. John, coming up at the end of this month, we'll have a couple of huge events here in the Valley. One is the Waste Management Phoenix Open, and the other is the Super Bowl. We're going to attract a lot of tourists here. Are these going to be people who are going to buy homes?
Yeah, some of them are. This is our prime season. Vacation homes is, obviously, Phoenix is a huge market for vacation homes. One of the little things that's kind of a worrisome is in Canada, the exchange rate with Canada is the loonies lower. So that's going to really hurt our Canadian buyers.
Right, the loonie meaning not the
Canadian dollar.
The
Canadian
right,
dollar.
Yeah, yeah.
The Canadian dollar, the exchange rate with the Canadian dollars. Turned against the Canadians. So now homes in Arizona are more expensive than they would have been if the exchange rate had stayed strong for them. So that'll hurt us because that's oftentimes Canada was our number two source of home buyers. Number one would be California. Mm-hmm. Number two is often Canada. So that should hurt us a little bit. And they tend to be, obviously, looking for vacation homes.
Yeah, Tony Sanders, those big events draw a lot of people here. Are those people who presumably can afford to invest here? And should the Valley want these investors?
Well, I think I agree with John. This is a good time to be attracting people. They come to Phoenix, they see how house prices are still relative to last decade, are very affordable. And that could be a big boon to the whole business. But the problem is, when you have investors running the show, you end up with the potential for speculative bubbles again, another rise up, another potential decline. You really want a housing market built by kind of sound fundamentals of home ownership. And what we've seen over since 2007 is mortgage purchase applications for loans from the FHA or a conventional are just, you know, in the toilet. There's no, people are not borrowing money to buy homes. However, we have a lot of investors driving the show, but that's come down a little bit recently. So will we see a revival of it? Well, we'll have to wait and see. But unless one of the two shows up to the party, Phoenix is not going to be growing that much in terms of house prices.
Well, how do the both of you think investors affected the market before? Because there was excitement about, well, someone's buying them. But how much of an effect, John, first to you, did that have on prices themselves? Did that artificially jack up prices?
It did jack up prices. It provided a floor to prices because prices were just, it was off a cliff. They were falling so quickly in 2008. And so the investors came in, they saw the bargains, and they supported it. They provided the floor to prices. And then as prices increased, they've pretty much left. We're back to sort of normal levels of investor purchases in Metro Phoenix now.
Yeah, normal's not a word, Tony, we usually heard with the Phoenix housing market. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, I never attribute Phoenix and normal in the same sentence.
We just had that's why you don't live here
anymore. A colossal bubble. It's a fantastic place to live. But the problem, of course, is that, you know, with the unemployment rate so high, and as John pointed out, Canadian investors are going to be less interested now than they used to be. Californians might still be interested in leaving, but watch for the Chinese to come in and more often than they have in the past.
Interesting.
They've been investing incredibly in California.
The big question that we haven't talked about yet that I think we need to when we consider how Phoenix was hurt by the housing bubble, et cetera. Tony, what lessons, if any, were learned from the housing market? I mean, I know there was a lot more to it, obviously, than that. We talk about derivatives and talk about the economy in general. And internationally, what was going on in the international economy, of course, affected everything. But were there lessons learned? I mean, could this kind of enormous dip happen again at some point in a couple of decades?
The answer is they learn their lessons for the usual amount of time they learn lessons, which is about 3 years. Then they forget everything. Remember, part of the problem in Phoenix was adjustable rate mortgages had, I think, I wrote a paper and showed back in about 2006 and 2007, ARMs were something like 90% of the mortgage market in Phoenix.
Wow.
Or maybe even higher. And then there's still ARMs out there, but we don't
have the adjustable rate mortgage?
Yeah. We've gotten rid of most of the pay option arms, the real what we call exotic mortgage products. We've gotten rid of, for the most part, not completely, but from the bigger banks, we've gotten rid of stated income loans or no documentation loans. So now you actually have to prove you have a job, for the most part. Mm-hmm. There's still some out there. And now that we've gotten away from that, we tighten credit standards. We see credit score requirements for Fannie, Freddie, and the FHA for a while went shooting way up, but now their banks are loosening credit. Everyone's starting to loosen credit again, and we're actually seeing some not at the banks you would hope for, but for some of the smaller banks, you're starting to see all these no documentation loans again.
Mm-hmm. John, final
so
thoughts.
We're starting to,
go ahead.
So we're trying to forget. I don't think we can redo it.
John, final thoughts. You've got about a minute left or so. Follow up on Tony or your own thoughts about whether lessons were learned.
I think the main thing we need to remember is in Phoenix, we basically have a real estate boom and bust about every 10 years. And there was two in the 70s, but we need to have policies that add stability to that because that caused so much human pain when you lose your house. How does it, that affects the family. It's going to be the worst time in so many people's lives is when they lost their house during the real estate bust. So we should be more responsible for that. The other thing that I think is just to see the sociology of how everybody was wrapped up into the bubble when it was going up, how excited everybody was. It's fascinating. I should be a psychologist or a sociologist to understand that, but it was totally fascinating how everybody was into it.
It was fascinating, and then, of course, when it crashed, it was fascinating in another way, I guess, yeah.
I agree with John. I was at a restaurant in Phoenix, and my waiter came up and handed me a card and said, in addition to your meal, I'm going to happen to be a mortgage broker.
Oh my God,
this is bad news.
Professor Anthony Sanders of George Mason University specializes in real estate finance and investment. You can read his stuff at Confounded Interest. And Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com. Great to have you both on again. Thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Appreciate it.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. On Monday, Doug Ducey became the 23rd governor in Arizona history. In his inauguration speech, Ducey emphasized his opposition to raising taxes in response to the state's budget deficit.
It will be said that the state has already found all the savings that can be found. Cut every line item that can be cut, and now every option exhausted, it is for the people to pay for the shortfall with higher taxes. And I will reply, not on our watch.
That was Governor Doug Ducey on Monday. So how should he approach his new job? Ducey's been state treasurer for the past 4 years, but that tends not to be an in-the-trenches position in state government. Will his business experience make any difference or give him any sort of advantage? Joining me is Chuck Coughlin, president of High Ground Public Affairs. He was a close advisor to former Governor Jan Brewer and worked on the campaign staff of former Governor Fife Symington. Chuck, good morning. Thanks for fitting us in.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So Doug Ducey's been in government, as I said, past 4 years, but we still hear that emphasis on his business experience. Can he actually translate that into being an effective governmental leader? Because we always hear, well, you can't really run government like a business.
Yeah, and I think there is absolute truth to the fact that he can bring experience from his business sector background, his private business sector background, to government and to rethink the way government does things. Governor Brewer really didn't have that opportunity in 2009, and she didn't have Doug's background. We were, at that point in time, she was confronted with a $3 billion, you know, 30% of the state budget wasn't there. And so it was a dire situation. And so we didn't have, we couldn't really fine-tune things. I think with the size of the deficit that this administration is looking at, and his business background, he can be much more similar to Governor Symington, who I was his deputy chief of staff and has worked on his campaign as well. And when Fife came into office, he did do a reinventing government program and found that, looked at ways to reinvent and redo government. Governor Babbitt did it with DES. DES was actually the Department of Economic Security was created under Governor Babbitt, when he combined a whole number of agencies under one umbrella and created some efficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is an opportunity, and I think that's something we should expect to hear next week, about looking at creating efficiencies in state government, combining tasks and resources, and re-looking at the way things are done. And I think that's a healthy thing for government to go through. The question at the end of the game is, you know, are all those oranges we're squeezing? it's sometimes the effort, given the task at hand, is often not worth the pain and suffering of what you have to do to actually go get that types of savings. And that comes from, you know, the myriad of laws and regulations, which are different, as you pointed out in your intro, from a private sector CEO who runs their own company. You're inheriting, you know, decades and 100 years of law here. And so there's many things that constrain the chief executive of a governmental entity that don't constrain the chief of a private sector enterprise.
Yeah, Chuck, so let's come back to Governor Brewer, because, you know, for better or worse, it's hard to believe someone would know government better than Governor Brewer did with all the positions that she held. So, but did she have certain advantages then that Doug Ducey won't have, or, in, you know, in some ways, not to be too naive, is there a feeling that Doug Ducey doesn't have some of those things to be thinking about quite as much because he doesn't quite have to or know as much about how government has traditionally worked?
I think there's unquestionable, like John Arnold, the governor's budget, both Governor Brewer's and now Governor Ducey's budget officer, said to me a couple months ago, he goes, Chuck, I don't think we'll ever have a chief executive ever in the history of Arizona who inherits the job with as much experience as Governor Brewer did at the time. She had, as you indicated, over 30 years of government service, from the legislative to county supervisor, then to Secretary of State, and then to the governor. So, you know, she was intimately familiar with how government itself works. What she wasn't familiar with was, and nobody is until they get the job, is the entire enterprise And so, you know, having the reins of the entire enterprise and being responsible for those, which is something Doug does have. Doug does have that as the CEO of a fairly large private corporation. So both bring very different skill sets to the table. And I think both can, as we saw with Governor Brewer, you know, very tough times, a lot of courage politically in doing some of the things she did to remedy that budget deficit at the time. And perhaps this administration doesn't have that type of political experience, but they certainly bring to the table a different view in terms of how government can operate and different things and challenging the paradigms that government currently operates under. And I'm quite frankly looking forward to hearing some of his ideas, because I think that's healthy, as I said, to have somebody go through and say, why are we doing it this way? And why can't these two agencies do these things similarly? And why can't we get some savings out of that?
Chuck, last question for you. Do you expect legislative leaders to want to work closely with him on his goals? We've heard Andy Biggs say, this is going to be great. We've got the same goals. Yeah. But ultimately, I mean, you know, I would consider in the background that's probably not going to happen. But do you expect there to be a kumbaya for at least a while?
I do. I think there'll be a fairly harmonious relationship with the legislative leadership at the outset. But that will be tested over time, because the roles of, you know, a governor gets elected by a much larger segment of the electorate. And, you know, as Harry Truman was once said, you know, the buck stops there. But the buck stops. There's only one president. There's 50 governors. And that's where the buck stops. And you have to ultimately be responsible. And as Doug pointed out, or Governor Ducey pointed out in his State of the State, or in his inaugural address the other day, mm-hmm. you have to balance some of those interests. And he spoke highly of his commitment to education, his commitment to higher education, his commitment on a number of programs, which he spoke to, which are counterweighted with some of the realities of the budget that he's faced with. So he will have to balance those as the chief executive and negotiate those things with the Republican legislative majority. And as you said, I think the first year will go, you know, well. I think there's tools at their disposal right now to get them through this year. But it's a two-year cycle that we're in. We're in a two-year legislative cycle, and I think we should all be listening to what he has to say, not within that result of perhaps just this year, but those two-year cycle that we're in right now and how we can attempt to solve those problems going forward.
Chuck Coughlin is president of High Ground Public Affairs. He's been a close advisor to former governors Jan Brewer and Fife Symington. Chuck, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
For another perspective on what Doug Ducey should focus on, I'm now joined by Robbie Sherwood, Executive Director of Progress Now Arizona. Robbie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Robbie, your biggest concerns about Governor Doug Ducey?
You know, if we want to take it from, there are many, but if you want to take it from the inaugural speech, my biggest concern was Governor Ducey laying down a line in the sand that he would under no circumstances bring in new revenue to the state, you know, not on my watch, which was akin to saying, read my lips, no new taxes. I think the problem he's facing is bigger than his ability to solve it without doing that.
And that brings up, to parse words a little bit, with read my lips, I guess I wonder, is there a way that he can actually do that? Are there, regardless of whether people think it's fair or unfair, and the cuts obviously in many cases hit a lot of agencies very hard over the past several years, can he and the legislature make these cuts, regardless of public opinion, based on the numbers possible? And if so, do you think they'll do it without conscience?
You know, I think that it's going to be a huge challenge. You know, let's reserve complete and final judgment until we see the governor's budget next week. I agree with a lot of what Chuck said, remarkably, about that process. But in my mind, I just do not think that there is $1 billion in the state government to cut. I thought Governor Ducey, you know, he was obviously very vague. An inaugural speech is a time for platitudes and forward-looking optimism and all that was to be expected, and I think as Arizonans, we're all wishing him market well. But I do not think that there is $1 billion in the budget to cut. The only real place where that sort of money exists is in the public education system. And I of course, they can do it. It's there. They can cut that and do that to our schools. But I think it would result in the governor not reaching any of the other goals that he expressed, which is to put an open for business sign in Arizona and to attract corporations and businesses from other states. What CEO wants to invest in a state that's about to devastate an already devastated school system?
Robbie, that's
workforce development.
Yeah, that's a good segue, because how do you react when Doug Ducey's business experience is cited and praised? The first question I asked Chuck Coughlin about was this idea that it really seems like in reality, when business people come in, they want to run government like a business, and then they seem to realize you really can't do that.
Yeah, I think that that's a reality that will dawn on the governor very, very quickly. I don't want to replay the entire campaign, but there were a lot of questions about exactly how well he did run Coldstone Creamery when he was there before he sold out. So I'm hoping he doesn't actually run it like he did. We'll be in even more trouble than we're already in.
Do you think he'll be his own man?
I agree. I don't disagree with people who say that Governor Ducey has a CEO mentality in which he likes to be the person who makes the final decision. But I think that, you know, we're all a little worried about the special interests that funded a lot of the outside spending to his campaign. We don't know who these people are and what they expect of the governor what allegiances he may have that weren't articulated in the campaign. So there's a little worry about that. I think he's in a tough spot. I don't envy the governor at all, because there are a lot of competing interests that make this situation untenable. He had very strong support from the Chamber of Commerce, and they're expecting the tax cuts that they passed. And it was just $200 million worth of corporate tax cuts that were passed a couple of years ago that were delayed. They expect for those to kick in. That creates a fiscal problem with some of his biggest supporters. He's promised to fund and support education, and yet the only way to balance the budget without a tax increase is to harm the institute he's promised to protect. We could go into social issues with Center for Arizona Policy and bills like Senate Bill 1062, which he promised the Arizona Republic Editorial Board that, you know, he had no interest in signing. And yet he receives such strong support from the religious right and Center for Arizona Policy. I'm sure they're expecting him to sign something if they can get it passed. It's all a very messy situation. We have a honeymoon, but it's going to be a short one.
Robbie, final question for you, last minute or so. Are organizations like yours or other progressive and left-of-center organizations going to be out front and loud, or more behind the scenes stuff? You don't have to give away your strategy, but is there going to be a feeling that this is a brand new governor, we'll try to work with him, or, you know, we'll try to also be on the offensive?
We're very optimistic and hope springs eternal, but we're not going to be in the background in the least. In fact, I'm glad you asked. There will be a rally, sort of a pre-sponse, or if you will, to the governor's State of the State speech on Monday at the Capitol at 10 a.m., where a large number of progressive organizations and workplace rights and voter rights and immigration rights organizations are gathering together for a one-stop response focused on common sense solutions. So not just expressing our worry over what the state legislature has done or what the governor campaigned on, but coming forward with some ideas that we hope they'll take up, that quite honestly should have strong bipartisan support to help Arizona out of this mess. And one of them would be the new revenues that I spoke about. They really should consider going back to the voters for a Prop 100 style tax of some sort, which was bringing in $1 billion to the state at one point. And that's roughly the size of our deficit. So, I'm a liberal arts major, but that math adds up in my head as a common sense solution to what we're doing. And the world didn't come to an end when that tax was in place. And further, not to take this conversation too deep into the woods, but the supply side economic Laffer curve people should have got a much bigger benefit from a billion-dollar tax going away a year and a half ago. And frankly, Arizona's economy has languished in that time. We're a full percentage point behind unemployment of the national range. And so even the theories that they're saying will work to spur our economy haven't worked in the face of a billion-dollar tax cut.
Well, we'll have to see how that goes over the next year, 2, and 4 years with Doug Ducey. Robbie Sherwood is Executive Director of Progress Now Arizona. Robbie, thanks for the time.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Still to come on Here and Now, what about these no-burn days we had over the winter holidays? We'll talk with Eric Massey of the Department of Environmental Quality. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by High Health, kicking off your new year with the 13-week Optum Metabolic Weight Loss Challenge. Registration at any High Health location or online at highhealth.com/lose-to-win. High Health, living healthy every day.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Should be a partly to mostly sunny day in the valley today. Quite pleasant, a high near 77 degrees. Mostly clear skies tonight, a low in the lower 50s. And a few clouds rolling in tomorrow. It'll be just a tiny bit cooler with a high expected to be 72 degrees. Join us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now. We'll get the latest on the deadly terror attack on a French satirical magazine. And at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, more and more of the latest technology is going into your car. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. It's partly sunny and 67 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:47.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Over the winter holidays, including Christmas and New Year's Eve, the valley faced no-burn days. That raised the ire of a number of residents who complained about not being able to sit around a crackling fire with their families, especially when nighttime temperatures dropped into the 30s. So where do no-burn days come from, and what kind of air quality do we have in the winter? With me to talk about that and some other topics is Eric Massey, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality's Air Quality Division Director. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
Eric, give us some background, because I think people might be confused about who decides on no-burn days and what are the qualities that bring those about?
Sure. So in terms of background, the issue here is that usually on our four major holidays, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, we've had historically bad air quality conditions, especially for people that have breathing problems, the elderly, the children, anybody with asthma. They tend to have breathing additionally due to the soot that's in the air, mostly from the wood-burning exercises that we see people going through this time every year. And like anybody else, we all like to have that fire, but we have to call those no-burn days based off of the meteorological conditions that we look at here in the valley and making sure that we're doing everything that we can to think about other people that actually suffer quite a bit during this time of year.
So is this a typical pattern that one would just kind of expect this time of year based on the weather patterns, based on the topography of the valley?
Yeah, you know, so meteorology and topography play a big role in what we're looking at here in the valley. This time of year, we tend to have strong inversions, which cause air pollution to be trapped a lot closer to the surface of the ground, if you will. And when we talk about an inversion, really what you're looking at is that air is not able to mix. The air at the surface is colder than the air that's aloft, if you will. And so what that does is that kind of almost creates a lid on the valley and keeps all of that pollution really close to us. So it's both a topography issue and a meteorology issue.
So there's no great conspiracy so that people can't enjoy Christmas or New Year's with their family then, Eric. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's right. And so in terms of conspiracy, and I appreciate that because we read the comments here as well, and we take that all to heart. But what we want to remember in this time of year is that the Christmas holiday and this part of the season is really about giving. And what we want people to remember is that they're giving the gift of clean air when they work with us on these no-burn days. In fact, we want to say thank you to all of the citizens of Phoenix right now on behalf of the elderly and children and asthmatics because we actually didn't have any exceedances of our soot standard this year on any one of those 4 days. And so for the first time, as far back as our records go, those people that were in those sensitive populations didn't have breathing issues, and they actually got a chance to enjoy the holidays much like the rest of us who don't have quite those same complications. So again, a thank you on their behalf, and remember that this is a season of giving.
Eric, so for folks who didn't necessarily follow the no-burn day declaration, how can that be enforced? Who does the enforcing?
So enforcement is a good point, and I'm going to diverge just a little bit to say that, that the campaign itself is really more about asking people to do the right thing and giving them the opportunity to do that and explaining the reason why. But in the off chance that, that people are out there doing burning on a no-burn day, the Maricopa County Air Quality Department does have inspectors in the field. They are out looking for those. There are as little as warnings all the way up to $250 citations.
All right, so going forward, Eric, we've got some big events coming up. Later this month, we've got the Waste Management Phoenix Open, obviously the Super Bowl at the very beginning of February. I guess I'm wondering, air quality, what sort of air quality? Maybe you can't look ahead, but based on patterns you've seen, based on the meteorologist the department talks to, is there reason to think air quality might be good? Do we have any idea?
You know, historically, our problems have centered around the Christmas and New Year's holidays. We haven't seen as many issues related to big events like the Super Bowl or things like the Phoenix Open. The unfortunate part is we can't tell exactly because we do rely on meteorological forecasts. If the conditions look right and we're starting to see an increase in smoke being trapped at the surface, we may call a no-burn day in the days leading up to that. That's still a possibility. But historically, we haven't had those kinds of problems around those big events. It's really just about the number of people that want to spend their holiday around a crackling fire for ambiance or for other reasons. And one of the things to consider is that there's actually a number of different options for those people available to still have that fire without creating the soot. It just means you can't burn wood.
Eric, finally, you sort of talked about some of the things we should be positive about. I'm wondering, is there anything that the department, any steps that are still being taken or things that are sort of long-term that the Valley is getting better at?
You know, so the number one thing that we're trying here at the department, and I think it's important to talk about it as part of this no-burn campaign, is really asking people to do the right thing and then and believing people will actually go about doing it. And I think that's a stark difference for how this kind of an issue is dealt with in other places, right? You know, Phoenix isn't the only one that's dealt with wood smoke issues. We've seen it all throughout the West Coast and East Coast over time, and specifically in places like Seattle and Tacoma, the effective strategies for reducing wood burning was very heavy fines. And a lot of enforcement. And so what we're really looking at doing is trying to educate people about what it is that's going on, why it's important to not burn wood on those no-burn days, and to remember the fact that people are, you know, suffering with ailments that we might not ourselves see. But generally speaking, you know, if we can keep those people in mind and ask people to do the right thing, generally we're finding people do that. And that it's a bit of a departure, I think, from the way that a lot of regulatory agencies go. But we certainly believe that if you ask people to do the right thing and give them a reason to go do it, they're more than willing to go do that for you.
Eric Massey is Air Quality Division Director for the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Eric, nice to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Phoenix area is a desert, but there are some communities that have more prominent greenery and lawns. In a lot of cases, that's been maintained for decades by irrigation. But what are the complications around irrigation? Kayla White, Arizona Republic reporter, has written about irrigation in the Valley and joins me for a few minutes. Kayla, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what areas and residents around the Valley are served by traditional irrigation?
So usually this is in neighborhoods that are in historic downtown areas of cities in the central area of the Valley. So, you know, think of downtown Tempe's Maple Ash neighborhood or Catlin Court in downtown Glendale. And most of these people get their irrigation from SRP, and SRP's district is Phoenix, Tempe, the western parts of Mesa and Chandler and Gilbert, as well as southeastern parts of Tolleson, Peoria, and Glendale.
One of the things I found most interesting about your article is, first of all, who provides the irrigation service and how those providers are doing financially and the costs. There were some numbers that surprised me, certainly.
Yeah, so the majority of people who get the service, about 22,000, get it through SRP. And they actually get it from a different part of SRP that's called the Salt River Valley Water Users Association. And they operate about 1,200 miles of canals and channels that serve the bulk of Metro Phoenix, and they operate at a deficit. And they the only way they offset these costs, and they have for years, is through SRP's electricity sales. And in three certain Valley cities, this also operates at a deficit, and this is in Glendale, Tempe, and Mesa. And this is kind of an interesting setup because the city really just acts as an agent between the resident and SRP. So the resident pays the city, and in turn, the city pays SRP and uses the money to hire, you know, people to do the work for the residents. And, you know, one of the notable cities is in Glendale. This has cost at least $100,000 per year for more than a decade, and it's added up to $2.2 million in cost since 1998.
Based on the folks you talked to, is there a lot of tension around this issue?
You know, in most of the cities, there isn't, but it has become an issue in Glendale. And that's because, you know, so in Tempe, this has cost a lot of money from Tempe's general budget. They have spent more than $800,000 from their own capital improvement budget on improving the system. And that kind of makes sense for Tempe because they also use it in parks. But in Glendale, a lot of people have become upset over the fact that the system in certain parts is falling into disrepair and they can't seem to get it fixed. And that's because of this unique problem that is because the system is so old. It's more than a century old in most parts. And in Glendale, or actually all across the valley, the system actually belongs to the neighborhood that it's in. So if you are in a home that is able to get irrigation, the pipes belong to you and you have to fix it. But a lot of people who get the service through the city want the city to fix it. So this is where the conflict comes from.
That's interesting. I mean, is there a possibility that could lead to significant changes in the future? Could there be negotiations that say, you know, we know you've had irrigation for a long time, but if you don't want to pay for it, we don't either, so you're out.
Right. And, you know, specifically in Glendale, for decades, they've had this debate, and they've had boards and commissions who have, you know, proposed possible solutions that range all the way from, you know, pay $12 million to fix the system, all the way down to abandon the system and destroy the pipes. And when you talk to a lot of officials, though, they say none of these are really plausible. The only changes that ever seem to take hold are, you know, gradual increases in the rates for these customers. And I know for SRP, too, I mean, they have no plans to abandon this system.
Kayla, finally, I wanted to kind of, one more quick thing. I grew up in an area that used irrigation service, so it makes sense to me. And I'm, again, from all the people you talk to, is there a vibe that suggests, you know, we are in a desert and it's nice to have green lawns, but that's not a great idea anymore, so irrigation service should be passé?
Well, you know, I actually have the best answer for this from the city of Tempe. They did a study a few years ago that found that the average total water use for one of the properties that gets flood irrigation is an average of 500,000 to 600,000 gallons of water, which obviously is significant. But for the most part, only about 60,000 gallons of that is potable treated water. And then for residences of similar size and landscapes that use potable water, they use 300,000 gallons, but that's all treated. So a lot of people make the case, well, yeah, I know I use more water than you, but, you know, mine isn't using chemicals, it's not using resources, it's better for the land. But, I mean, one thing to note is that in the same study, the third group were people who have residences of a similar size, but they have xeriscapes or low water use landscapes, and their water use came out to 100,000 to 150,000 gallons of water a year. So, I mean, I think they're the clear winner, but I also think we've known that for quite a while.
Kayla White, Arizona Republic reporter, very interesting story about irrigation in the valley. You can find it online at azcentral.com. You can also follow Kayla on Twitter at Kayla White. That's KAILAWHITE. Kayla, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much for listening to today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks as well to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. If you missed any of the interviews or want to go back to hear any of our past programs, you can go online to kjzz.org later this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Xavier College Preparatory, a Roman Catholic high school for young women, administering an entrance exam this Saturday at 7:30 a.m. for interested 8th graders. No reservation required. Info at xcp.org.